Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in.
Hello there, welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, as usual, and I have here with me Andy Steiger.
Good to be with you today.
So Andy, you just came back from all the way from Ontario. What was going on there?
Yeah, we, you know, by the way, I'm reminded of how big Canada is.
Really?
Yeah, whenever you hop in a plane and try going anywhere in this country, it's ridiculous. You know, like, the distances are vast. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yes, after almost a 5-hour flight to Toronto, had an awesome time there. Did an interview on 100 Huntley Street on my new book that came out, Thinking, Answering Life's Five Biggest Questions. And then when that interview was over, I raced off to Barrie for our very first Apologetics Canada conference in Ontario. Right. And in fact, like, it may be the first Apologetics Canada, or first Apologetics conference at all in Ontario. A lot of people were talking about that. Like, it's hard to say, you know, just what would constitute Apologetics conference.
Right.
But most people think that this was probably the first of its kind.
Right. And it was the same when you started it in BC too, wasn't it? Like,
It was the first in British Columbia.
Right.
Yeah. First Apologetics conference in British
Columbia. So you went all the way from Toronto to Barrie, which is about an hour away, and you went through
the snowstorm. Yeah, if there's no traffic, it's easy.
Yeah.
Just an hour. You know what? There was a blizzard that morning, but I got there right at the end of it. So
okay.
The cars were full of snow, and it was freezing cold, but we made it. And
Were there some memorable moments there?
Yeah. First off, the conference started that Friday night with Greg Kokel and Richard Howe, and we had over 500 people, like, and that church, I don't know how many they'd seat, but I guess it would seat 550, maybe 600, maybe, but I don't think so. Cause it seemed very full. So we were all pleasantly surprised. Like, it was a great attendance.
Awesome.
People were really keen and excited. And lots of great discussions were had. So the Friday night went really well. Each speaker gave their talk, and then Q&A followed. And then on the Saturday, we had, you know, just like here, we had a number of keynote addresses and then a number of breakout sessions. And today on our third part of zombie culture, if you remember, we've been talking about zombie culture as any worldview that leads to dehumanization. And so today we're going to be looking at the third part of this, and really a great segue for this is what was being discussed in Ontario while I was there. I noticed that a lot of people on their minds, and that was being discussed, and people were really concerned about, was some new legislation that was passed in the schools, or that's seeking to be. I'm not as informed on this as I'd like to be. It seems to me like this is what's being pushed for, and I think people have the opportunity to push back on it. But this is what will be, if nothing's pushed back on it, will be implemented in September, is a new curriculum. And so there's different things in this new curriculum that people find disturbing, and that was being talked quite a bit about. Now, really, it was grade three, what's being taught in grade three, that was on most people's minds. But I'll just give you kind of an idea of what is being proposed from grade one on. And this is in the, the overall teaching, whether, from physical fitness to sex ed. Now, clearly, it's the sex ed portion that's concerning to people. And by the way, I was reading through it, and one of the things that I found fascinating reading through the whole thing is really our school systems, and I know there's a side topic, I'm not going to get into it, but it's something to think about. Our school systems have become parents.
Right.
And as I'm reading through this stuff, I'm thinking to myself, this is all stuff that parents should be talking to their children about. And our school systems have become glorified parents. Now, the problem is if you're going to let the school system parent your children, which is what we've developed in this country, is they're going to teach them what they believe then. Mm-hmm. And so here's some of the implications. So grade one, students will learn how to understand nonverbal signs like facial expressions and tone of voice, as well as proper names for body parts. This apparently is already in the old curriculum. By grade two, they'll be learning about the stages of development related to bodily changes, along with the concept that no means no. Now, here's the one that's really controversial is by grade three, students will learn about same-sex relationships. They would learn about kids with two moms, two dads, and about these kind of families. And that ultimately, as this curriculum wants to teach, that these families are just like everyone else. By grade four, they'll learn about the dangers of online bullying and posting and sharing sexual images, while specific lessons of the dangers of sexting will come in grade seven. In grade five, they'll be learning about puberty. By grade six, they'll be taught about masturbation and gender expression, while grade seven and eight will discuss contraceptions, anal and oral sex, and preventing pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. So as you can imagine,
wow,
times have changed.
Times have changed.
The sorts of discussions that are being had are much different than when we were in school. Now, one of the things that came out in all this and that clearly was concerning for people was specifically in grade three on sexual orientation. And one of the things that is being discussed then in grade three is that there are six forms of gender.
Six.
Now, these six forms of gender that are being discussed is male, female, transgender, transsexual, two-spirited, and intersexed. And so not only then are our children being taught this, but then they're being encouraged to determine, obviously, which sex are they. This is what's being taught, and more than that, this is what's being mandated that you must teach in every school, whether or not it's public or private. So if you're a private Christian Catholic school, it's being mandated that this is what you must teach. And so as you can see, this is clearly raising some issues here in Canada. And so here we are now in session three. We're in series three now of zombie culture, and we've been talking about these ideas that lead to dehumanization. And so just as a recap, how did we get here and what are we going to talk about? Mm-hmm. We've been looking at the fact that there were four main things that were created in the Genesis account, and that God is necessary in all four of these, particularly for us to be human, for us to understand ourselves as people. And so we started with Genesis chapter 1, which we talked about God creating the universe. And then we looked at the implications of what happens when you remove God from being the creator of the universe, and that we become just particles and set in motion.
Mm-hmm. Naturalism.
Naturalism, physicalism, materialism. And then we looked at the second thing that was created, and that was life, that life was created. And so we looked at, well, what happens if you remove God from life? And what you find is what we called reductionism, and that a human just reduces down to amino acids or DNA, and ultimately leads to determinism. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden moral accountability goes out the window.
Right.
Well, now the third thing that was created and that we want to talk about today is relationship. And specifically, this is going to be in Genesis chapter 2. Now, next time when we meet, we'll discuss the fourth thing that was created. Now, this wasn't created by God, and that is evil. Evil was created by people in chapter 3, but we're going to look at that God's necessary for us to even be able to have a conversation about evil. I'm going to leave that. Obviously, I don't want to waste our time with that today. We'll get into that next time. But if in Genesis chapter 2, I'm looking at verses 18 to 25, and we see the creation of relationship. And there's some unique things here that we need to understand and that are important in our culture today. And this is what we read. Then the Lord God said, It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him. Now out of the ground the Lord God had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave the names to all livestock and to the birds of the heavens and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fitted for him. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed." Now, one thing just to note here, this is something that I had thought a long time about. Did we get the name woman from like womb man, you know, like from Genesis? And the and that is not the case.
No.
It is just a coincidence that yeah. they have some relation, but in yeah. fact, they're not related.
The Hebrew words there is she shall be called Isha because she came from Ish. So there's a bit of a wordplay there, but it's not like – it just happened to be a convenient kind of man, woman, ish, isha kind of a thing. So,
yeah, and in fact, when you look at the etymology of the word woman in English, it has a unique etymology of how it came to be, but it's not related to Hebrew. At any rate, that all said, there's a couple things here that I think are important for us to take a look at. And the first is – that notice that when God created life and he created people, created a human, that it wasn't good for this man, for this human to be alone, mm-hmm. that this man needed a partner. Mm-hmm. Now, without going into great detail on all this, because there's other things that we want to get to, what I want to jump into is this idea then that God takes a rib mm-hmm. From the man. Steve, this is a Hebrew word. What's the best we can do for pronunciating it?
We'll have to brutalize it, but the the way we usually say it in English is Selah.
Now, I say that because if you hear somebody that speaks Hebrew pronounce it, it's going to sound a lot more Hebrew than when we pronounce it. But the important thing to understand is when you study this word in Hebrew, you find that it is very difficult to translate this word. Now, we've often adapted the word rib, mm-hmm. but what you find is that a better idea or translation maybe, mm-hmm. This gets into the nuancings of translation, but really what we're looking at here is the side or the half mm-hmm. of the man. It's like God took half of the man,
right.
or half of his, you know, rib cage or side of him, mm-hmm. and that he fashioned another half. And so what you get this idea then is you get this idea of completion. Mm-hmm. And that's why the word rib works well, mm-hmm. is because it's a bone that has its complementary bone.
Right.
Right, so you have one rib, but then on its other side you have the mirror of it, and you have its other rib.
Right.
And so the idea here is that you've got half of a person, and that he is made whole with his other half.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we could make up a word, a great word here would be like counter partner,
mm-hmm.
that these two become one. And this is helpful to understand in that when the Bible refers to the woman as the helper or helpmate. This isn't a derogatory term. And in fact, God in Hebrew is referred to as our helpmate.
Right.
So if it were derogatory, then it's speaking derogatorily of God as well.
Right.
But it's not. The idea here is that it's your completion, it's your second half, that this person makes you whole.
Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, an idea that we're pretty familiar with, I think, that God is, in a sense, he's the one who makes us complete, right? And mm-hmm.
And that we're incomplete without God.
Exactly, yeah.
And so the same thing then here is happening with the man, that he is incomplete. Mm-hmm. You know, Adam is incomplete without Eve.
Which is a bit of an interesting thing to observe, because all this is happening before the fall of humanity, where Adam's relationship with God wasn't breached yet. The trust wasn't breached yet. And yet God looked at the man and said, it's not good for him to be alone. And so we are just made to be in relationship like that. It's there is something there that we just need our equal to be able to relate to one another and have that relationship.
This gets into a unique topic that we don't have time for, but I'll just give a little bit to you. Mm-hmm. And that is that humans are inherently relational. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's how we refer to anything. We really have a hard time. We can't relate to anything non-relationally. So like, I think about how we often name things, like our car, mm-hmm. right? I'll give my car a name, or I'll refer to my car as a him or a her. Mm-hmm. We do this with things. Mm-hmm. Like we can't even tell a story. There isn't even such a thing as a story without giving human characteristics to something.
Right.
Now, the technical term for this is anthropomorphic language. Mm-hmm. I think of like the story Charlotte's Web, right? Mm-hmm. Where you've got a spider and a pig and a horse, and and we've given them human characteristics. Why? So that we can relate to it. Because we relate to everything relationally, and ultimately, this to me is, I think, inherent in just the fact that we were made in the image of God. When we think about what kind of image were we made in, well, we were made in a relational image. Mm-hmm. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God is relational. Yeah. And we've been made in that image, and it shouldn't surprise us then that we inherently need relationship. Now, this is an interesting idea, by the way, in that relationship, or the completion of relationship, is found in three and not two. Mm-hmm. Now, this idea I find fascinating, in that we experience that you have Adam and Eve. Now you've got two, right? Then, mm-hmm. but you would say, okay, well, there seems to be a lacking of a third. Now, what's the purpose then of Adam and Eve? They complete one another, but yet they also have a teleological. They have a design component. Mm-hmm. And what would that design be?
Procreation, I would say.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Procreation. And so now you have that third component, mm-hmm. that the two come together, and that there's this third. Mm-hmm. And now in this relationship then of three, is fascinating, that the husband and the wife can know one another and they can have this love relationship. Mm-hmm. But whenever you've been married, you are married,
yeah.
currently, and you and your wife recently had a child. Mm-hmm. And so you know what
and
I'm talking
about. By the way, when Andy says recently or a couple of days ago, it can be anywhere between 2 days to 5 years.
How old is
Maya? Is just turning 19 months now.
Okay, so that's in the realm of recent for me. Yeah. By the way, shout out to John Morrison. And Haley, they just recently had a girl.
Abigail. Faith.
Yeah, so very excited for you guys.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring that up is you love your wife, Sharina, mm-hmm. and Sharina loves you, and you guys have this relationship, this love. But when you had this child, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you two are experiencing a love for one another that you previously didn't know.
That is very true. It just takes on a whole new dimension. Maybe it is the sense of common cause. Now, we are both in this together to mm-hmm. take care of this child and raise this child. Maybe that sense of assuming responsibility together
introduced you into a new form of relationship. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These things are all fascinating, and I'd love to talk more about them. But I want to get back and just stay focused on this idea of the fact that we were made for relationship. Mm-hmm. And that this is absolutely vital and important to who we are as people, and that when we lose sight of this, we actually lose our humanity. We begin to lose an aspect of what it means to be human. Now, one of the ways that we see this, or the loss of this, is in our culture today. We live in a culture that has lost sight of gender. You know, we've lost sight of what it means to be male and female. Mm-hmm. I mean, currently in Vancouver, where we are, there's a big push for gender-neutral bathrooms, mm-hmm. right? So that so that you can kind of pick which bathroom you want to go to, because you pick which gender you are, and that all of a sudden gender is no longer about your biology.
Right. It is about social construct. Yeah. It's what you choose.
It's your preference.
Right.
You know, how do you feel? Mm-hmm. And inside of that, it begins to lose what it is. Now all of a sudden we live where you've got, you know, six genders, mm-hmm. you know, and I've seen more than that. Mm-hmm. Particularly now we live in a culture of, where we need more pronouns. He and she doesn't fit anymore. Now we need more pronouns, and we've come up. But by the way, that we haven't. As I've researched this, there's been no consensus on what these other pronouns will be. Mm-hmm. These gender neutral pronouns or whatnot. But the fact that we live in a culture today that even dictates that you need such things,
right,
becomes problematic, because now we've lost sight of that design component that makes us who we are, this counter partner, right, this other person that makes us whole. Now, this is where some people say, well, okay, what if we still have that in he and he and she, you know, is the relationship found there? And that's where I was getting to that idea that there's a problem here, that there is a design component to relationship inherent in what God created. Mm-hmm. That we weren't just created for relationship, but this relationship had a function to it. In particular, like we mentioned earlier, procreation. That the two come together as one and they procreate, they have children. What I find fascinating in the culture that we live in, and this is often referred to as a death culture, is that in our loss of appreciation for what God has created, that God has created us for relationships with the purpose of creating life. Mm-hmm. When we lose sight of that, and we lose sight of it in different ways in a death culture. So, for example, when a culture embraces abortion, you embrace this culture of death that no longer has the relationship have this procreation function to it any longer. And notice what happens. You know, you see this dehumanization of an individual. Now all of a sudden this fetus, notice that we call it a fetus, mm-hmm. right? We will use language that is dehumanizing, mm-hmm. so that we can, in fact, because we don't kill people. Notice that. And when we've been talking about that, and we'll talk more about that, this idea that, you know, as we've seen in genocides in the past, genocide is almost always preceded by a campaign of dehumanization. Right. Whether that be the Nazis referring to the Jews as rats, mm-hmm. or the slave trade referring to blacks as animals.
Right.
Right. That when we do this, it helps us to be able to do awful things to people. You can't do terrible things to people. You need to dehumanize them.
Isn't that fascinating, though?
First,
that we somehow feel it in our moral conscience that we can't do these things to people, to persons. Right? There is something in us that says, well, no, it's not cool. It's not right to do this to a person. So we're just going to deny that they're persons.
That's
so
right.
what is this that's been built into us?
Oh, absolutely. This is you know, that God's moral law has been written in our hearts. There's mm-hmm. there's no doubt about the fact that we intuitively know that people have inherent worth and value. Mm-hmm. They were created in an image beyond ours. Obviously, as Christians believe that they're created in the image of God and that they have inherent worth. And so what we do then is we remove that inherent worth from them so that we can, in this case, an abortion, we can kill this clump of cells, this fetus, whatever it is. Now, in this case, a person. Right. Now, this is the problem as well in homosexual relations. These also lead to a culture of death because these relationships don't procreate. They don't produce life. And so what happens, and by the way, consumerism is a culture of death because consumerism, when it's teased out and when it's followed, doesn't lead to procreation.
How so?
It doesn't lead to procreation in the sense that kids are expensive. And in our narcissism and in our desire to have more things and to live better and greater lives, kids are expensive. Right. I mean, what I heard, like a kid on average costs you $250,000 by the time they're 18.
They're 18 and they leave home. Yeah. I think I've seen something like that
before. I think I just saw a report that was done on that. They're expensive. And if, as I'm well aware of, if you have more than two, you're going to need to get a minivan, right? Uh-huh. And as we're all aware of, once you start having more kids, plane flights become more expensive.
Really expensive.
Right? Homes need to be bigger. Mm-hmm. Kids need things, right? Mm-hmm. And so in a culture of consumerism, in a narcissistic society that is consumed with itself, Children are a burden, not a blessing.
And I really kind of felt that, I guess, when I came to Canada. Because in Korea, like my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation, our culture was such that, you know, for your children, you did whatever it took to make sure that they succeeded in life. Mm-hmm. And so it is not at all uncommon to hear stories of grandmothers and grandfathers working well beyond it. I mean, there was no such thing as retirement back then in Korea, right? And so they would work every day, nonstop. There's no taking days off. If that meant seeing their children through school. And so my aunt, I have one aunt, and she's a dentist now, and it took a lot to get her through dentistry school and things like that. But my grandmother and my grandfather, they did it willingly. And so I then come to Canada, and I see this sense of, oh, I need to take my time off. And there's some wisdom to that, right? Self-care mm-hmm. and things like that. But I do notice that sometimes, you know, you go overboard and I notice the kind of a stark difference there that narcissism and consumerism coupled together, it results in fewer and fewer children.
That's right. That we would ultimately refer to, again, as a culture of death. Now let's just give some numbers then to this. Uh-huh. So we see in places like Germany, the birth rate is 1.38 currently.
Per family?
Yeah. Now think about that. No, that's just on the average.
They have
a birth rate of 1.38. Now, Now think about what would be necessary to sustain your population. You'd need a birth rate of two. Right?
Right.
Now, two actually is not quite high enough because
people
die.
Yeah.
People die of accidents, mm-hmm. right? And so, or different causes that require you to have a slightly higher birth rate than 2% just to maintain your current population. Right. So now think about that then. Germany's got a 1.38. Japan has a 1.41. Canada has a 1.61. China has a 1.66. The U.S. has a 1.88. Now that, it used to be that the United States was at a two or a little bit higher, that it was uh-huh. sustaining its population. That's no longer the case. The UK has a 1.90. Now look at this. India has a 2.50. What we see then is you have countries like India, China, many places in the Middle East that have high birth rates. They have a lot of people. We have in the West very low birth rates. So what then do you do if you have a low birth rate? Well, you have to employ mass immigration, right? And so in Canada we have mass immigration. Now we are well aware of this requirement. I guess China. I did say China. Had a higher birth rate, but they only actually have a 1.0.
I guess it's because of their one-child policy.
Yeah, right? Which apparently they're just recently changing.
Yeah.
So ultimately then, what happens is you have mass immigration into these populations just to sustain their population, let alone to have any sort of population growth. And what we're seeing then in places like Canada, and Europe is well aware of this, you're seeing the culture change. Now, this is nothing new. This has happened throughout time, throughout history. But Europe is experiencing this in dramatic ways, as in France right now, their Muslim populations are really high because of the different people from Muslim countries that are immigrating. And in fact, France needs to immigrate there to sustain their populations, or their entire economy is going to collapse. Right. But at the same time, the French, whatever that means, are dwindling away.
Right.
They are going extinct, if you will.
Right.
But that's what happens in a culture of death. I mean, it shouldn't surprise you that if you embrace things like consumerism, narcissism, if you embrace things like homosexuality, if you embrace things like abortion, they don't produce people. And if you don't produce people, your numbers are going to go down. And the countries that do value people and that are having children, their numbers are going up. Now, this is exactly what happened to the Romans. And in the wealth of Rome, and the consumerism and the narcissism of Rome, and the embracing of different lifestyles in Rome, their populations went down. Everyone else's populations went up. Lo and behold, the Romans got conquered. My whole point, though, with all of this isn't, you know, like, fear-mongering or something like that. It's just to inform people, like, this is the reality that we face right now. And I find that most policymakers are, they understand what's going on. But I find the average people just don't realize the implications of these beliefs. So this is one of the things for me that in the whole debate about homosexuality or gender, whatnot, to me, this is such a bigger topic than whether or not homosexuality is right or wrong, or the whole gender question. I mean, I think when people get stuck just there, they realize that this is such a bigger issue. That this is an issue of embracing life and the purpose of what man and woman were meant to do. They were meant for relationship, but that had a design component to it, that it created life, and that we need life or we die. And ultimately, though, what I want to land today is that these implications become even more sinister when we look at what happens in a culture of dehumanization. Because what we're seeing right now is something that I don't think people really expected. And I think a lot of people expected that our populations were going to just continue to skyrocket and go through the roof. And I can't help but wonder if what we're going to start seeing is a decline in populations. Or what you're going to see is, like, other countries' populations are going to continue to rise, and we're going to continue to have immigration taking place. But one of the things that we see in places like Japan that doesn't allow for immigration, they don't try to, from what I understand, they're very insular, Japan as a country, and they don't allow for people to immigrate into Japan or become Japanese. You can live there for a while, but you can't become Japanese. You have to be born Japanese. Is that your knowledge as well?
I believe so. I have a cousin who lived in Tokyo for a long time, and he never got his citizenship. I don't think you can.
Yeah, I don't think you can. So what's happening, though, in Japan is interesting, in that they're kind of this experiment of what takes place then in a culture like this, that embraces a culture of death. And what we're seeing in places like Japan, now I'm not trying to pick on the Japanese, but in a lot of studies, they've been the source of research. And what we've seen is that more and more people stop dating. They stop getting married, and they basically start more, they begin to live on their own. And this is having huge implications and huge problems in Japan. They've even got campaigns now where they're trying to encourage people to date again, mm-hmm. that they're encouraging people to get married because their economy's in ruins, mm-hmm. and people aren't having children.
Yeah, that's going to make things worse.
And it's going to make things worse. There was a survey that was done that asked, have you ever thought that marriage isn't for me or I prefer the life of bachelorhood? And 40% said yes. 60% said no. So you have huge numbers mm-hmm. that are saying marriage isn't for me and I just prefer to be a bachelor.
Almost half.
Yeah, almost half. Now, in the survey, people said some of the reasons why they preferred to just be a bachelor. And so here you've got a 36-year-old said, to me, married men just don't look happy. And the more time passes, the more this look of unhappiness becomes apparent. A 24-year-old in medical care profession said, all your hard earnings in the blink of an eye disappear into oblivion. That's housekeeping. A 45-year-old said, keeping relations with your partner's family is bothersome, to say the least. Another 45-year-old said, I like my own space, and I can see that if I were to get married, I'd lose a lot of my free time. Mm-hmm. A 25-year-old said, from impressions alone, marriage means throwing your hobbies out the window. 30-year-old said, when things get too busy with work and you're getting home late, the last thing you want to do is keep company with the other half. Mm-hmm. Think about the other half.
Right.
28-year-old said, those living the single life seem to retain their youthfulness longer. See, I think you can start to see this narcissism, right?
Narcissism there.
Yeah, coming out. Well, this isn't just an issue that Japan faces. This is, in fact, an issue that we face. We face it here, actually, in the West. And more we're seeing surveys and reports coming out that people are preferring pornography over relationships, mm-hmm. and that people could see themselves just satisfying their own sexual needs and not needing another half. And so again, what you begin to see is this dehumanization that we lose sight of what we were created for, our needs, and the actual design inherent in the way that we were relationally created. And so right now, we see that pornography is through the roof.
Mm-hmm. It's the biggest industry on the internet.
Yeah, and the amount of people struggling with it, both male and female, mm-hmm. is astronomical. Now, the problem obviously being is that it just doesn't stop there. It's not just this online thing that's happening. What's happening in the virtual world is having real effects in the physical world, in the real world, that people are seeing that they can just satisfy themselves online and that they don't need other people. That's one aspect. But another aspect that we're seeing is that this pornography itself leads to dehumanization. It leads to dehumanizing treatments of people. And in fact, some of the most well-liked pornography is pornography that dehumanizes another individual. Now, if you have kids in the car, I would shield them or wait to hear the second portion. But I was reading a report from Triple X Church a couple years ago. Triple X Church is an organization that seeks to help people get out of pornography, mm-hmm. both those in the porn industry and those who are watching porn. And one of the reports they talked about was that the vast majority of pornography ends with a man ejaculating on a woman's face. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that's graphic, but you need to understand the dehumanizing that's taking place in with events like that is treating another human being as an object.
Right.
And in fact, it should disturb people in a deep way why you would actually find and mm-hmm. do find mm-hmm. that attractive. I mean, if anything, I think that it really speaks to the brokenness of humanity that humans are attracted to the act of dehumanizing another individual. That's a whole nother topic in and of itself. The where I wanted to land as we finish this discussion is my wife and I were recently, a couple months ago in March, at an NCAA tournament, the March Madness. We went to a March Madness in Portland, Oregon. We were watching a game, two games. And what I found fascinating is during the halftime, during the breaks, they kept playing these commercials on the, you know, the Megatron things.
Right.
And it was about rape. And it was about how prolific rape culture is and about the need. And really, they were just addressing trying to stop what's taking place in college campuses. Now, if you haven't heard, I mean, CNN did a report at the beginning of the year when college started, and they were reporting that one in five females will be sexually assaulted in their college experience.
And that's a scary thing to hear as a father of a girl. That's very
Those aren't good odds. I mean, one in five are sexually assaulted. So clearly, if at an NCAA game and they're constantly showing these commercials, we realize as a culture this is a problem. Mm-hmm. But you have to ask yourself, why are people doing this? Why is rape culture so huge? And I think that the answer is quite simple. When we take God out of our relationships, we will dehumanize one another.
And notice that connection too, right? When we were talking about in the first session, when you take God out of creation, you end up with physicalism. And in the second session, when you take God out of humanity, so to speak, that you end up with reductionism. And they're all part of this process. And so
Objectification.
Exactly.
You now have an object.
Right. The human then is reduced down to whatever, maybe just the body parts, or maybe in the case of slavery, it's just, they're just tools to get things done and things like that. And so naturalism naturally sort of, or physicalism naturally gives rise to reductionism, of which dehumanization is a branch or a strain.
That's right. And so now what you have is these colleges full of people that are treating females as objects. Mm-hmm. They are reducing them down to just, it's just flesh and bone. It's just DNA. It's just chemicals, you know, and ultimately then the question becomes, well, why shouldn't I, gratify my desires, my sexual desires with that other person, right? Why not take from them what I need? You know, it's just a chemical reaction.
Right.
And ultimately we don't value that other person as a person any longer. We've now dehumanized them. And ultimately we're seeing that taking place on our college campuses. And that the idea of what a relationship was meant to be and what it was for and its design now has been completely lost. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately this will just continue, this culture of death and the negative implications of it. And so this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk on this subject, because I think we really need to get culture to understand that this issue is so much bigger.
Right.
Than people appreciate, and it has implications that are much more far-reaching than just, should my son or daughter be taught about these six different genders? That's important, and we need to address it, but we need to address it because of the implications are so much greater than people are appreciating.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways, our skeptic friends will often look at religion or faith traditions as sort of a spiritual fantasy club, really, that has nothing to do with the real world. But as you can see, you take God out of the world. Whether this world is actually theistic or atheistic has huge implications for in everyday life, you know, because that will determine whether I treat you as an actual person. So you are reducible to your personhood rather than your particles, so to speak, your cells. So I think that we really need to keep that in mind. It's not just a spiritual fantasy club talk. We're not just, you know, spewing hot air. We're talking about stuff that actually has practical consequences.
You know, it was interesting earlier this year, to go along that line, Emma Watson, you'll remember from the movie Harry Potter.
Yes.
Who did she play? What's that character's name?
Hermione?
Yeah, Hermione. She gave a UN speech on gender equality, and particularly for this campaign, he for she. Mm-hmm. And the idea just being that that we need to get men caring about women. Mm-hmm. And that in many aspects of feminism, right, or equality, you know, was founded on good ideas. I mean, there was inequality taking place, mm-hmm. and that women needed to be treated with respect. But the problem is we've now come to the complete. We've come back to the same problem, where and Emma Watson's seen this, where women are still not treated with respect, with the respect that they deserve, and that ultimately she's arguing and wanting men to come on board and mm-hmm. and help, right? Because that's ultimately what's going to need to happen. Because especially in our culture right now, we're seeing that men aren't doing that. What men are doing is they're watching porn. What men are doing is objectifying women. What men are doing is trying to get women drunk at some party and having their way with them. That's what's happening. And ultimately, this for me was one of those real eye openers where I began to realize that men and women were not created equally in that sense. That yeah, we were created equally, but that in fact, God called men to treat women actually better than they would treat themselves, mm-hmm. and that God created women to actually treat men better than they would treat themselves. And in fact, Philippians 2 says that we should have this attitude in us that Christ had, that he humbled himself, mm-hmm. that God humbled himself, became a man, became a servant, mm-hmm. and sacrificed and served for his beloved us, right. and was willing to die for us. And that we, in our turn, have this responsibility to treat one another with respect. Mm-hmm. But the question is, this whole he for she thing, well, what's that going to be founded on? What moral principle mm-hmm. is that founded on? How do you found this idea that you should treat one another with respect, that you should, that a man should give up his seat for a woman when she comes on a bus, mm-hmm. let's say, or that a man should treat his wife or should treat any woman with respect and shouldn't just take from her whatever he wants, or shouldn't just objectify her or submit her to pornography or whatever that may be. Like, you know, again, what principle is it?
Right. If physicalism is true.
That's correct.
Then reductionism is true. And so whatever you do, like even if you do it out of quote unquote respect for the woman, you're really doing what is fashionable socially at the time. And if the moods of the society changes, then you will most likely change along with it. Because it's what you're really doing is you're not doing this because it is actually right. You're doing this because you think it's right. Yeah. And who's to say that you're not thinking wrong?
Right. And we've seen with atheists that that don't necessarily see problems with certain aspects of rape, mm-hmm. because well we see it in the animal kingdom, and it, you know, if it happens there, or you know, like, you know, how can you say that rape is wrong? I'm sure it's taken place in the past, and if it serves some sort of, you know, naturalistic function, well, maybe it's just part of, you know, the natural world, if you will. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, we all know that that's not true. That rape is wrong, and we inherently, again, in our hearts, know that you shouldn't do that to another person. Mm-hmm. But again, it's going to come back to how are you going to, on what ethic are you going to found he for she, that we in fact do need one another, mm-hmm. and we in fact do need to treat one another with respect, mm-hmm. and ultimately, as we've been arguing from the beginning here, it's going to require God, that we were created by God, and we were created in him, his image, a relational image, with the purpose of relationship, and that in particular our relationships with men and women have a functional role, that we were created for a relationship with one another, and ultimately I'd actually argue that that's the purpose of marriage, is relationship, but that relationship does have a function, and ultimately that function is procreation.
Okay, well, very good. Thank you for joining us, listeners. We'll come back next week with the last episode in the series of Zombie Culture Talk. Thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been the Ministry of Apologetics Canada. We'll see you next week. You're all gonna die screaming. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and